Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Hi, this is Cale Clark. Welcome back to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. It's our series on Exodus, the power of God and the presence of God. Let's pick up our Bibles once again, and we'll finish off chapter 1. We're going to introduce you to some heroines in Scripture that you might not have thought about. Let's pick it up in Exodus chapter 1, starting with verse 15. It says, "Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiprah and the other Puah, 'When you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live.' But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, 'Why have you done this and let the male children live?' The midwives said to Pharaoh, 'Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and are delivered before the midwife comes to them.' So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, 'Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live.'" Okay, so Pharaoh obviously goes here from slavery, and the section just before this that we read had to do with his enslaving the Hebrews and forcing them to work hard labor in his building projects. And now he goes from slavery to genocide. And so we have here the account of the midwives. And so in verse 15 and 16 of chapter 1, we see the problem that the midwives have. And they really are the main characters in this little vignette here. And we see here in verse 15, it says that the Pharaoh said to them, and in verse 16 as well, "When you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him, but if it is a daughter, she shall live." And so this idea of weakening the population, they don't want any leaders rising up, military leaders, to possibly take vengeance upon Pharaoh and the Egyptians. And so at first it seems like Pharaoh is trying to keep this on the down low. He's trying to keep this plan to kill all the babies a secret. He's only talking to these midwives for the Hebrew women. And they're, by the way, just to explain their names, Shiprah means beauty and Puah means splendor. So those are the two names of the women, essentially beauty and splendor. And Thomas Dozeman, on his commentary on Exodus, he says that essentially what's going on here is this is all about civil disobedience. That's what the midwives do. And there's actually a play on words in the Hebrew text of Exodus chapter 1 in verse 16 and 17. There's the word, the term in Hebrew, which is translated as to see. And this comes up in verse 16. Pharaoh says, "If you see the Hebrew women upon the birth stool," okay, "if you see them there, if they give birth to a son, kill them. If it is a daughter, she shall live." But then it says in verse 17, the midwives feared the God. And in your English Bible, it just says feared God. But the actual Hebrew text is they feared the God. And I'm going to talk about why that is in just a second. But in Hebrew, the word that means to see and the term that means fear, they sound the same. So it's a play on words. So the Pharaoh says the midwives have to kill every male Hebrew child that they see born on the stones. Now, what on earth does this mean? The two stones. You might have heard the crass expression in popular culture. If a guy has a lot of courage, they say he really has stones. And it's a reference to certain male body parts. And that actually might be what is intended by the sacred writer here. It may, in fact, refer to the testes. In other words, these are male infants who are to be killed. It also may mean the place of birth. In other words, these are birthing stones, giving birth upon the stones. Not exactly the most comfortable entrance into the world, but nonetheless, we're not quite sure which is meant here. But we do know this. Pharaoh wants to strike fear and terror into the hearts of the Hebrew people. But here's the thing. He wants them to be terrified of him. But the midwives are not scared of him at all. In fact, they're scared in a very healthy way. They have the fear of God. And not just God, it says the God in the Hebrew text. Why does it say that? Why does it say that the midwives fear the God? Well, Dozman says it's probably a literary device because it's really impersonal. It doesn't give God's name here. It just says the God. Now, later on, we do see the name of God revealed. In chapter 3, God reveals himself in the burning bush to Moses, and he reveals his personal name, Yahweh. I am that I am. It's a very mysterious name, for sure. But having the God here makes it so clear that to them, to those midwives, at this point, he's a very mysterious God, perhaps even remote, unknown. It's very much like in Acts chapter 17 in the New Testament, when Paul goes to Athens, they want to make sure they have their bases covered. So they have altars to all their pagan gods, and they even have one to an unknown God, just in case they missed one. Well, at this point, to the midwives, God is really unknown, the one true God. Now, why is that? Because as we've been saying, don't forget, everything that happened at the end of the book of Genesis, that comes right before Exodus, that's all been forgotten by this point. Pharaoh has forgotten Joseph and his God. He was the number two man in all of Egypt at one point. Joseph's family comes to Egypt. They're treated with honor. Jacob, Israel, and all his sons, the progenitors of the 12 tribes, all of that is forgotten now. It's much, much later. Even the Hebrews themselves have lost touch with God in a certain sense. And it seems as if God has lost touch with them. God has maybe forgotten about them. Why are they in slavery right now? Well, don't forget, God foresaw and promised that this would happen even to Abraham, but he also promised that he would lead them out with an outstretched arm of power. So at this point, though, God is very much unknown to these midwives. And what's interesting, too, is that because they don't have personal knowledge of God, how is it that they can fear him? The reason is it's because of their conscience. It's because of their conscience. The very fact that they were created in the image of God means that they have a conscience. They didn't know the law explicitly. The Ten Commandments hadn't been given yet. All of the other laws that God would give Moses, that has not been revealed. Yet, as we know, it is literally written in the human heart, the human mind, the human soul. It was in the back of their mind, if you will, through their conscience. Now, what is your conscience? There's a lot we can say about that. And later on, we'll do a little bit more of an extended meditation, if you will, or explanation of the role of conscience in the Catholic life. I remember when I came back into the Catholic Church, one of the things that shocked me, but it's true, the Church teaches that we are absolutely obliged to obey our conscience. It's a grave obligation. Even when our conscience is wrong, that always was a head scratcher for me. Well, the reason is because the word conscience means literally conscience, with knowledge. That's why we have to have our consciences formed and informed in accord with the truth, because they can be off kilter sometimes. If we continue on in a lifestyle of sin, we're going to see this happen to Pharaoh. His heart will become hardened the more he turns away from the living God. And that can happen to us as well. So our consciences aren't always a sure guide. However, we do have to obey them. And let's try to inform them with the truth. So the story of these midwives and how they feared the God, it means that they were obeying in their conscience the directive not to murder an innocent human life. And they refuse to do so. And that's a big tension that's here at the end of Exodus chapter 1. Are they going to obey the directive of Pharaoh? Are they going to act upon what they see? This is what Dozman reminds us of. Are they going to act upon what they see? Remember that pun, that play on words. When they see the Hebrew male children born, are they going to kill them? Or will they follow their conscience and act justly because they feared? And that's the word that sounds the same, because they feared the God. Well, clearly they choose the latter. They act in accord with their fear of the God. They fear God, not human persons, no matter how powerful they may be. In the case of Pharaoh, probably the most powerful person in the world at that point. So as Dozman says, this is really kind of the manifesto for civil disobedience. And that's exactly what the midwives do. They allow the male babies to live, and they also lie. They lie when asked to account for why they did what they did. Now let's look at this in verse 18 and 19. Let's go back to the text here. It says that the king of Egypt called the midwives. He obviously found out about this, that the male children were surviving, and said to them, "Why have you done this? And let the male children live." The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and are delivered before the midwife even comes to them." So Dozman says, when Pharaoh inquires why his order is not being executed, quite literally, the midwives actually play on his fear. They strike fear into Pharaoh. What they do is they talk about the difference between the Egyptians and the Israelites. Now, Pharaoh has taken great pains to say, "Hey, they're not like us. We don't want these people here." Well, this is what the midwives say to Pharaoh. They say, "The Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. I mean, they give birth and then they're gone. They just go right back to work. They are really tough. They are built for tough, if you will. They just give birth and keep on trucking. We can't even get to the babies." So in saying this to him also, they play upon his fear that, you know, he's afraid of this explosive population growth of the Israelites. And these midwives, boy, I tell you, they're just having fun with Pharaoh. They are just savage, you know, and he's pretty savage too. So they're giving him some of his just desserts, if you will. So they say, "Hey, they're just teeming with life, these Hebrew women. They give birth and then they're gone." And that's exactly what Pharaoh is afraid of. Now, some people think these midwives are not heroic. The Protestant commentator John Calvin, he was one of the first Protestant revolutionaries. He actually says that they were being sinful because they lied to Pharaoh. And so he basically says that this is a great example of how everybody's got mixed motives, and we all need divine grace. We need purification. Okay, that's true in general terms, for sure. But come on, man, or maybe I should say, come on, Calvin, because Johannes Calvin, that's his French name. Anyways, I digress. I think they're heroic. They're absolutely heroic. It's a little bit like in World War II, if you were hiding Jewish refugees in your attic and the Gestapo knock on your door and ask you, "Hey, are you hiding people in your attic?" Of course you're going to say, "I'm not. Don't be so silly." Is it lying? Yeah, technically, but it's for a good reason. You're trying to preserve human life. Now, here's another question about these midwives. Are they Egyptian or are they Israelite? That's actually not that clear in the text. They have Semitic names, but when the text in the Hebrew text calls them the Hebrew midwives, it's not that clear. It's not that clear. They could be actually ethnically Hebrew, or they could be the midwives for the Hebrews. Now, we don't really know. Now, later on, there's a Greek translation of the Old Testament that comes out much later. You might have heard of this. It's called the Septuagint. because of the alleged 70 translators and editors of the project. And sometimes that's abbreviated as LXX, capital LXX, which is the Roman numerals for 70. So you might have seen that. Now, later on, the Greek Septuagint says that they actually are Egyptians in that translation, but I'm not so sure. What do the rabbis say? That's a good question. Well, in the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, it actually says they are Hebrews. And in fact, this is kind of interesting. Some rabbis actually said that Shipra, you know, one of the women, they actually say that Shipra was actually Moses' mother, Jochebed. It's just a different name for her. Pua, they say, well, that's Miriam. That's Moses' sister, Miriam. Now, I'm not so sure about that. There's a rabbi named Rashi, the famous Rabbi Rashi. Now, he was very known for making rash decisions about interpretation. That's why they call him Rashi. No, I'm only kidding. But he also says this. The famous Rashi takes that line of interpretation. I'm not 100% sure, but there's some interesting rabbinical teachings on this passage. In fact, there's a Jewish legend that Miriam, who's identified with Pua here, actually calls down the wrath of God on the Egyptian king, on Pharaoh, for being so nasty and evil. But we do know this. God does reward the midwives for their heroic actions. We're going to get into that in just a second. But because they're so brave, in fact, some even modern scholars like C. Myers, they actually say, well, they've got to be Hebrews because there's another guy named Prop who says their brave defiance of Pharaoh implies that they are Hebrews themselves, not righteous Gentiles. In other words, it kind of goes with this whole motif in Exodus of the fact that God is going to fight against Pharaoh and his people are going to be set free. But I don't know. Others disagree with that. Josephus, who's a great historian of the times, he wrote about this too. He thought that they were Egyptians. He was maybe influenced by the Septuagint. And he says, well, maybe they are kind of like righteous Gentiles. Another scholar, a more modern scholar, Leibovitz, says, in the Bible, the fear of God is a demand made on every single person created in his image. A Gentile devoid of the fear of God is branded by the Bible as a traitor to his elementary obligations as a human being, end of quote. So, hey, that's a really good point. The dictates of the natural law, the conscience, the law of God as revealed, hey, that applies to everybody, not just the Hebrews. So if you fail to respond to your conscience, if you fail to do the right thing, you're kind of a failure as a human being in a certain sense. That's a really good point. And that gets back to the primacy of conscience, which renders everyone in the world without excuse. Read Romans chapter 1 if you don't believe me. St. Paul writes, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men who by their wickedness suppress the truth. And that's what happens when we don't listen to our conscience. The truth gets suppressed. Paul goes on to say, for what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. And it goes on. We don't have time to read that whole chapter, but it's a great meditation by Paul on how no one has an excuse. Everybody knows or should know a little something about God. They've all got a little light, a little truth that they can follow. And of course, God gives more revelation. And speaking of revelation, there's much more to be revealed about the book of Exodus, and we will do that in the next episode of The Faith Explained, right here on Relevant Radio. But stay tuned, there's much more to come. In this section of the program, I just want to expand a little bit about a subject that came up earlier, the role of conscience. This is so misunderstood in the modern world, and I think if you want a great treatment of this that you can read, it's a short book, it's not necessarily easy reading, but it well repays you for the time that you put into it. It's a book called On Conscience by Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger, better known to most of us as Pope Benedict XVI. It's a collection of two essays that he, which are really speeches that he gave, one in 1991, and he gave this talk to the National Catholic Bioethics Center, and another talk that he gave in 1984 to the bishops, both on the subject of conscience. It's a nice little book, and it introduces you to his thought on this. Now, in our modern world, there's this false dichotomy that's been set up in which people want to say that the church's magisterium, the church's teaching office, is simply imposing everything it wants to say on you. You're sort of hapless. You're just kind of passively accepting this. And our own consciences are being overridden by this monolithic church. Now, that is simply not the case. That is a caricature at worst of what's going on. And so Cardinal Ratzinger, one of the things that he said, he certainly did hold what the church teaches, that we have to act in accord with our conscience, even though our conscience may be mistaken. We have the sacred obligation to obey it no matter what. We do have to form it. It has to be worked out, if you will. And that's a good analogy, really, working out. Yeah. Conscience is kind of like a moral muscle that needs to be exercised, just like we might go to the gym and work out our biceps or our quadriceps, whatever. We've got to form those muscles, keep them in shape. And the same is true with our conscience. It is the message from God to our souls from eternity. We need to work it out. We need it to be formed properly. And so one of the things that he said in one of these talks, and this was the one he gave in 1991, Cardinal Ratzinger said this. He said, quote, "It is strange that some theologians have difficulty accepting the precise and limited doctrine of papal infallibility, but see no problem in granting de facto infallibility to everyone who has a conscience." End of quote. Now, that's a very kind of wickedly funny statement that he made there. A lot of liberal theologians, they deny doctrines of the church like papal infallibility. And papal infallibility, that's another subject for another day, but this is a negative protection for the church, and it's only been used twice since the doctrine was defined. It's not as if popes are making infallible pronouncements every weekend or anything like that. So theologians often have problems, liberal theologians, with doctrines of the church, but yet when it comes to conscience, they say, hey, whatever you feel, just run with it. Your conscience is a sure guide. They deny the need for formation. Now, in the introduction to this little book, On Conscience, by Pope Benedict, John Haas mentions something really, really important. There would be no moral norms at all. There'd be no need for moral norms if everyone was actually able to figure out subjectively on their own what's right or wrong, if our consciences were infallible. But they're not. We have to form them. There's a few ways that we can do that. First of all, we draw upon the shared experiences of the community of which one is a part. And this is where sacred tradition really comes in the teaching of the church. It's often been said that tradition is the democracy of the dead. You know, they get a vote too. There are reasons why people have believed these things throughout the centuries, and maybe they ought not to be torn down. G.K. Chesterton has a famous analogy of a fence that you find out in the middle of a field. Hey, why is there a fence here? Well, before you tear it down, you might want to ask around and find out why it was put up in the first place. And so the shared experience of a community is very important in forming conscience, especially the community of the church. There's the family, there's the wider community, but then there's also the family of the church, and they help us to form our consciences. The nature of reality itself. And we're talking really in some ways about natural law here, that can inform our conscience. And then there's, of course, revelation from God, divine revelation, the teaching of the church and scripture and sacred tradition. That helps to form our conscience in accord with the truth. Aside from messages that we get directly from the conscience. So again, we have to be careful with those because our consciences need to be formed. And that's certainly true. And he gives the example in his writings, and as a young man, he saw the atrocities, lived through the atrocities of Nazi Germany. The German National Socialists, the Nazis, they thought it was fine, the crimes that they were committing. It didn't bother their consciences at all. Or maybe they did. Maybe they were bothered, but they had smothered those screaming voices of their consciences as one might kill a person with a pillow. And they at any rate, serious damage was done. And this is culpable. When they silenced the voices of their conscience, didn't listen, and didn't think, well, maybe I should follow up and not do this because it's wrong. That's a culpable sin for sure. And then one last thing I wanted to mention here. In the 1991 talk to the National Catholic Bioethics Conference, Cardinal Ratzinger talked about Plato, of course, Socrates and Plato. Plato was his most famous student. And you've heard of the Socratic method of asking questions. And Cardinal Ratzinger said that's a really good thing to do when it comes to conscience, because when we ask people questions, it forces the student to, quote unquote, remember what he already knew. You got to remember who you are and what you're all about. There's actually a Greek word for this. It's the same word that's used when Jesus institutes the Last Supper, the first Mass. It's the word anamnesis. It's translated in our English Bibles as remembrance. Do this in remembrance of or in memory of me. But it's actually much stronger than that. It doesn't mean to simply recall, total recall, if you will. It means to make present the one sacrifice of Christ. Christ himself is made present at every Mass. And that's kind of what happens when we have anamnesis. Cardinal Ratzinger talks about this. We remember, not just remember, but we make present the truth. And when that happens in our conscience, Christ is present there as well, for he is the truth. He's made present in his fullest sense in the Eucharist, of course, but also when his truth is recalled in our consciences and we abide by it, we are led to the light of truth. So I'd encourage you, not easy reading, but it's essential reading, On Conscience by Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger, published by Ignatius Press. Good place to get some more information. It's a good start. If you have a question for the Faith Explained program, you can email it to me, faith@relevantradio.com, or follow me on Twitter. Send me your question at Cale Clark is my handle. You can follow me there, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E, and the Faith Explained account is at Faith Explained. We'll catch you in the next one. God bless you. Peace.